Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of October 11th, 2013. To sum up the week in news, we need to head down to our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., Budget Fight Central. President Obama nominated Janet Yellen to replace Ben Bernanke as the new Fed chair in January. We'll get to that in a minute, but first, the Affordable Care Act. We're 2 weeks in, and we're going to, take its temperature. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein joins me from the health desk at WHYY. Welcome, Dan.
Hey, Lizzie. Thank you.
You've been covering the rollout of the healthcare exchanges. It's been bumpy. Where are we now? What's going on?
Bumpy like a 4x4 truck ride. I mean, this has been a really rough start to the Affordable Care Act exchanges. There's no doubt. I mean, there have been a lot of technical glitches, as everybody knows. What the source of the technical glitches is a bit of a mystery. We're not getting total transparency from the federal officials on that. But I think what is becoming clear is that not only was healthcare.gov, the exchange site where people can go and buy subsidized insurance, overwhelmed with a lot of visitors, it was also, there's some software problems.
A lot of this seems to depend on where you live. Some of the state exchanges seem to be working well. Everyone holds up Kentucky as an example of a success.
Yeah, no, a couple of states these past couple of weeks have gotten a lot of pats on the back. Kentucky's one, Nevada's another, New York is a third, where they've had some 40,000 people enroll and be eligible to begin shopping and looking for different plans. The state exchanges seem to be doing much better for any number of reasons. I think one key point is that, you know, the state exchanges just had to think about their own state, whereas the federal government, which is running 36 individual exchanges, had a much heavier lift to figure out all of the different bureaucracy, the different Medicaid programs, et cetera, et cetera. And what you've got with these state programs also, some of these states have built in, and I think Kentucky is one of them, you just put in basically your zip code, and then you can just start shopping and checking out all the different products available, all the different health insurance products, how much it costs, what the deductibles are, all of that.
Dan, a lot of the people coming into the exchanges have never had health insurance before. And so the price they may see for a premium isn't the entire cost of insurance. There's a deductible, there's a copay. How do they know what the real price of all of this is going to be? It's pretty confusing.
I think that there's a lot of consternation. I mean, you're right that a lot of people who are going to be going to these exchanges are going to be buying health insurance for the very first time. This is not a simple product to understand and appreciate. What people have to remember is the premium is just one part of the cost. You've got the deductible, how much you have to pay before the insurance actually kicks in. You've got out-of-pocket costs, co-pays, co-insurance, depending on the plan. There are lots of things and lots of technical jargony things that are going to confuse lots of folks. Now, one of the things that everybody needs to remember is there are call centers that people can call federally, whether it's the federal run exchange or the state-based exchanges. There are call centers, there are people who are trained to help walk consumers through this very tricky process.
Bottom line, consumers have a limited period of time in which they can sign up. From the people you've talked to, do you have a sense of how patient consumers are willing to be with all of these glitches and delays?
You know, I was talking with this one source. This guy's out in Seattle right now, and his job is, for the past year plus, has been to work with about 11 states that are putting up their exchanges and really kind of gearing up for the Affordable Care Act in their states. And these are, you know, these are the sort of most forward-leaning, pro-ACA states in the country. And he was talking about how all these staff who are manning the phones, who are taking in these applications, who are talking with the consumers who are finally getting health insurance for the first time in their lives, or who have fought with insurance companies for years and years because of their pre-existing conditions, the pure joy and elation has come across. We're talking about the glitches, but we're forgetting about the fact that there are a lot of people who are getting a product that they have desperately wanted. That means if you can't get it in day one or week one or even week two, because of technical glitches, you are willing to wait. That said, a lot of folks that I'm talking to are circling November 1st on their calendars because November 1st is about 6 weeks before the first deadline, which is December 15th. If you want to have health insurance coverage starting to kick in on January 1st, you've got to enroll by December 15th. People, based on the experience in Massachusetts, you need kind of a 6-week run-up to get all these people in. And let's not forget, in order to make the Affordable Care Act prices affordable going forward after this year, you need a lot of young, healthy people who don't have high costs to buy insurance. The more these technical glitches get in the way, the shorter the window is for people to sign up, the more folks are worried that you're just not going to have that kind of critical mass come in, enroll, and get this Affordable Care Act up and off the ground.
Dan Gorenstein covers healthcare for Marketplace. Dan, thank you so much.
Lizzie, thank you.
We want to hear about your experiences if you're shopping for healthcare on one of the exchanges. What are you finding and what do you wish you knew? Head on over to marketplacemoney.org and click on the contact link. You may have heard that President Obama nominated Janet Yellen to head the Federal Reserve. If confirmed, she'd be the first woman to do the job. The Fed can seem far away from everyday life, but it really matters to your wallet. Marketplace's economics correspondent Chris Farrell joins me now to connect the dots, a little refresher on why we pay attention to the temple of money. Plus, we're going to take some calls. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Lizzie.
Janet Yellen. We finally get the announcement. She's going to be the chair person, man, woman of the
yes.
Fed. Break this down for me. What does this mean for a regular person?
So for a regular person, the Federal Reserve is, well, it's one of the most powerful economic institutions in the world. And so when the Federal Reserve tightens monetary policy, so when the Federal Reserve decides it's time, you probably heard this expression, to start tapering from what it's been doing, interest rates tend to go up, and you would see that in higher mortgage rates. You know, the Federal Reserve activity affects the whole interest rate market. So if your auto loan is going up, well, it's probably going up because the Federal Reserve is running a tighter monetary policy as opposed to what it's been doing for the last couple of years, which is running a pretty loose monetary policy to try to support this economy. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but interest rates are really low.
And what do we know about Janet Yellen and where those interest rates are likely to stay? She's been a part of the Fed for a long time, and the Fed has pretty much said, we're going to keep those rates low, right?
First of all, she is a top-flight, top-ranked economist. She's been in the system, so she knows how the Federal Reserve banks work. She knows how the White House works. She knows how the Federal Reserve works. Since 2010, she's been the vice chairman of the Fed. And I think it's a historic moment to recognize, assuming that she does get approved, for the first time in the 100-year history of the Federal Reserve, a woman will head it.
And that's a really big moment. There are people out there
it's a
saying,
big moment.
We're talking about, you know, potentially the most powerful economic moment for women in the history of the world. That might be hyperbole, but that's a really big deal.
Yes.
We're talking about housing prices. We're talking about mortgage rates. So our first question is from Sandra in Chicago, and she's got a question about potentially buying a house. Sandra, your question was whether you are too old to buy a condo, but I want to get some backstory first.
Okay.
Because that was your top line question, but you were asking about prices going up, but I want to know what you're looking for and what you think maybe you can and can't afford.
Well, first of all, I'm looking for a condo. Prices had gone down so much that I started thinking about it, and I think it would be helpful for you to know that I've been a freelancer for a long time, and so I thought, well, this is an opportunity for somebody like me to finally buy. About 3 years ago, I took a full-time job in addition to my freelance work. So I now have steady income in addition to the stuff that I do normally.
And you say you're a freelancer. What kind of work do you do?
I'm an actor. And so, you know, for almost 20 years of my life, the income has been pretty erratic. But I've always been able to make a living. Anyway, so I started looking at condos, and then the prices started edging up. And then I started to think, well, if I'm facing a 30-year mortgage, would it be wiser to use that money toward investing and retirement rather than having a 30-year mortgage?
And how old are you?
I'm 49.
Young. Sorry, I had to leap in there.
I don't know. It just seems like
you're not
all
even
my
50
friends
yet.
With real jobs are further along in this whole process, you know?
Well, let me ask you, how much do you have saved up for retirement?
I have about $40,000 in a retirement fund, and then I have about $40,000 in my personal savings. I have no debt at all.
Well, that's great.
So the first thing, age doesn't really matter.
Okay.
The housing market fluctuates. So it's how conservative can your finances be when you buy? How secure is your income? Because I think that's really the key issue here that so many people face. There's nothing wrong with owning a home. Nothing wrong with owning a condo. There's nothing wrong with renting. The question is, over the next 5-10 years, how secure is your income?
Alrighty.
And also, by the way, well, you got 40,000 retirement savings, 40,000 in sort of emergency opportunity fund. So if you're renting and you're continuing to save for your retirement and you're continuing to put money into your emergency savings, you know, you're actually in a really good position over a period of time, better than a lot of people who are sinking all their money into a home. I mean, is that what you really want to do also, is put all your money into this condo? Because whether it's a condo or a home, they're expensive. You got to maintain them. You got to paint them. You're going to want to do things with them. You're going to add to them. And that can add to your quality of life, but it also draws on those savings. And you may have other desires, other goals, which mean if you rent and then save, you might be able to pursue those things more than putting the money into the housing. These are the kinds of issues I'd be weighing.
Which gives you the flexibility to think more broadly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think sounds like for me, the next step for me is to kind of sit down and make a list of what is it that I really want to do. I mean, I always imagine traveling more. I don't want to be eating cat food in my retirement. I have a lot of things on my mind, and that maybe I just need to sit down and figure out what the priorities are.
Thank you so much for calling, Sandra. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. I love the show.
And we love hearing from you. So Chris Farrell will stay with us to answer more personal finance questions from our listeners. Just ahead, first comes the proposal, then the pitch.
After I ended up getting the ring, I called up my current insurance company and had a valuable property rider put on it. And while that was happening, they were like, oh, you got engaged. Are you covered in other areas? Do you have life insurance?
That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. My guest this hour is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And our next caller is Catherine in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Of course. So I gather you want to talk about saving up for an emergency. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. My husband and I have both been working full-time for a couple of years, but we've only really been able to get together about 1 month worth of emergency funds, and that makes me nervous. We've had a hard time getting beyond that point, and just using the cash that we save each month, it would take us several years, probably closer to 5, to really get a solid 6 months saved.
Okay.
So I'm trying to find other ways to get there faster.
And you've got a young child, is that right?
I do, yes. My daughter will be 4 in 2 weeks.
Yeah, that sucks down the cash pretty quickly, doesn't it, having a little kid?
Yeah. I was just looking at the numbers today, and she's easily a quarter to one-third of our income right there.
I would think so. So tell me what you're considering in terms of how to get an emergency fund and what you're thinking about.
Okay, well, the bank that I use, it's one of the larger national chains. They have some gimmicky things that they do once in a while to try to drum up business. One of the things that they do on a pretty regular basis is offer super checks, which for a small interest payment up front allows you to take money off your credit card, and then after a 0% APR period, would begin accruing at credit card interest rate. I've got about $9,500 available on the card. And the most recent checks that I got would be for 0% APR until October of 2015 with a 5% upfront charge.
Ooh. I am pretty sure I know what Chris Farrell is going to say in response to this. I think I am going to just let him go, wind him up and let him go on you right now.
Okay.
In a very nice Minnesota way.
No, because, you know, I really feel for you. And when you said, you know, 5 years, you know, the buildup, that emerging savings, so many people feel that way. It is just hard to build up. I don't like the solution, though, and because you're really – borrowing for your emergency fund, and that really isn't the answer. At best, it's a temporary solution to what's a long-term problem. Plus, 5% is very expensive up front, and then you still have to pay the debt off, which will draw down your emergency fund. So I'm not a big fan of this idea. It's out there. I would steer clear of it. I don't think borrowing is the way to build up your emergency fund. I got a couple of other ideas, but recognizing that there is no easy way to save when, you know, you have a child, you have all your expenses, you're doing your work. I mean, you know, money comes in, money goes out, and I'm recognizing that. But I have two suggestions to make that may help you out a little bit. So
okay.
The first is, you know, and for a period, you know, think about for maybe a period of 2 to 3 months, really scrunching back. Is scrunching a word, Lizzie? I think it is. Scrunching back. We'll use it anyway.
We'll let it be a word.
We'll let that fly by. So, you know, in that 2-3 month period, putting more money into that emergency savings. Now, you only want to do this for a short period of time because you don't want to live a life of misery. But you do it for a short period of time just to boost that emergency savings. And then you go back to what you were doing before in terms of just constantly putting in every month. And the other thing is the discipline for everybody. And I think this is one of the, you know, there are very few laws in personal finance, but I think this is a law. If you can automate your savings as much as possible, it makes it really easy. So if you go to your checking account and you click on the thing that says, okay, every, on the 15th of the month, $50 or $100, whatever sum of money you choose automatically goes into your savings account. So you're not even thinking about it. And then if you have some extra money during the month, you know, an extra $25, you can go ahead and toss that into the savings account. But if you do this combination of 2 or 3 months, really just focusing on savings, that's what it's going to be about for the next 2 or 3 months. And then you automate your savings after that. You know, it is going to build up over time. And it will pay off over a longer period of time, because the thing that's always underestimated about an emergency fund, and we talk about an emergency fund, and you want to have this emergency fund in case you lose a job or whatever, but it then becomes your opportunity fund. You know, you can then spend this to get some education or to make a career change or a job change. Or if you do lose your job, you can take your time to find another job. So it starts out as this emergency fund, but over the course of a lifetime, it becomes your opportunity fund.
And I mean, it sounds like you guys are pretty disciplined already. I know that you said you guys don't have cell phones, and that
we carpool to work. We eat lots of beans. We're already pretty much there. We wouldn't be cutting out espressos and lattes at this point.
No, I understand. And that's why I say these things are always easier to advise. They're much easier to say than they actually are to do. But I think you're on the right path. I really do. I mean, just what you were saying and Lizzie, what you were noting. I mean, you're on the right path. You're going the right direction. And we all go through that period of time where it's just not growing. It's just not getting that big. But the surprising thing is, particularly if you can automate the savings, is before you know it, actually it does start to grow. And then it grows on top of itself.
Would it be better to set it to have an automatic saving that's higher than what I think we can do and then pull the money back, or to be cautious while putting the money aside?
I would be cautious because then you don't have to think about it. I mean, part of the reason why you want to do this is you want it to be – it's like with your – do you have a retirement savings account at work?
We do, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, the money's automatically taken out before it shows up in your checking account. So you don't even think about it. I mean, most of us don't. It's sort of like – what we look at is what's in our checking account. So it's sort of setting it up so you're not even thinking about it. It just happens every month. And that's why, though, I like the idea of going a little bit under so that you're safe. You're financially safe not to be thinking about it. And then, as you know, if there's an extra $25, sure, toss that into the savings account. But you don't have to worry about pulling back, which is an extra step.
Okay.
Catherine, thank you so much. I know this is not fun advice, but it also sounds like you guys are pretty dedicated savers and thinking really hard about how to do this well.
We do what we can.
Yeah. I absolutely echo that. I think what you're doing is great.
All right. Well, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for all your advice and all that you do every week. I think it's awesome to hear you guys.
Thank you for calling in.
You're welcome.
Chris, I want to put a question to you that we got online. We're staying in the Midwest. We've got sort of a trifecta of Midwest callers this week. This is Jenny from Caledonia,
Michigan.
You know,
it is part of the country. I just want you to know this. I mean,
my dad's
flyover country, but
I am a big Midwestern fan. This is from Jenny, and she wants to know what you recommend as far as naming a trustee when all the beneficiaries are underage and you don't have an adult family member who can do the job. Now, she says, ideally, it wouldn't be an issue, as we hope to live long enough that all the beneficiaries would no longer be minors, but there's still going to be someone who needs to wrap up the estate at some point. She's curious whether professional trustees are worth the expense and how she goes about finding one. What do you think?
Well, I think if there's not a family member that is willing to be a trustee, and by the way, just as an aside, if you know, that's usually how people pick a trustee, is they turn to a trusted family member that has some financial expertise. If you're asked to be a trustee, your initial response, of course, is to be yes. I'm so honored. You know, I'm part of the family, and this is a family obligation. Think twice.
Really?
Trustee is a hard job. Trustee can be a very hard job. It has a lot of
legal
obligations and responsibilities because you're managing this money. You're distributing the assets. You really are taking on a legal liability, and it can be a lot of work. And by the way, that is why a lot of family trustees now get paid. You know, you sort of say, well, like we, because one reason why you turn to a family member is it's cheaper, right? You know, hey, Bob, Uncle Bob, I don't have to pay Uncle Bob. Well, you actually should pay Uncle Bob if he's going to be a trustee. I mean, just to, you know, take account of his time. And just so we're all on the same page, you know, what a trust is, it's like a legal container. And you throw in, you know, it's got assets. So, you know, property, stock portfolio, Aunt Mary's coin collection, you know, all that stuff is in there. And you have a trustee that manages this trust. So, yes, I would turn to a professional. I would go, if you have a banking relationship, I'd go to the bank. And most banks have a trust department or they have a relationship with another trust department. If you're paying a professional, it's going to probably be about 1-2% of assets. But, you know, there's a lot of regulatory restrictions. They have to abide by the Uniform Prudent Investor Act. It may not be quite as ideal as a family member that you know and trust, but I think I would definitely deal with a professional, particularly in her situation, because it doesn't sound like she has much choice. So to start off the process, go to your bank, find out what they're offering, what the cost is. Another way of finding somebody is to, if you know somebody, a colleague, a neighbor, a boss who has a trust and they've got somebody that they're working with a professional, see if they are willing to recommend somebody. But I'd start at my bank, actually.
Okay. All right, Chris, you're going to hang on.
Okay, I will. I'm here.
And we're going to come back. We've got one more caller after we take one more break. My guest this hour is Marketplace's economics correspondent, Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
How you doing, Lizzie?
Our last caller is Ryan from Bala Cynwyd, Pennsylvania. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here. So congratulations are in order. You just got engaged.
That is correct.
So you want to talk to us about life insurance?
Yes.
What can we do for you today?
Okay. think I have a fairly basic question. Obviously, I just got engaged, and I'm just trying to cover my bases and look into what I should do in the event that we get married, and then, you know, I get hit by a bus.
Let's hope not.
Yeah.
Let's hope not. Yeah. But really, just, you know, I'm thinking I should be looking at term life insurance, but I really don't have a whole lot of assets, and so, you know, that's also part of the question.
I gather this came about, though, because of the insurance policy on your fiancé's ring. Tell me the story.
Basically, you know, after I ended up getting the ring, I called up my current insurance company and had a valuable property rider put on it. And while that was happening, they were like, oh, you got engaged. Are you looking, you know, are you covered in other areas? Do you have life insurance? And so that kind of set off the thought of, oh, maybe I should look into this. And that's kind of where it started.
They tried to upsell you, Chris.
Exactly.
So a couple of things. First of all, yes, you would want term life insurance. So term life insurance is a pure death benefit. And okay. If you drop your term life insurance policy, you get nothing. And the advantage of term life insurance is that it is cheap. And so it's really ideal for young people starting out their lives because it's not that expensive. You do get insurance coverage while you're also trying to, build up your retirement savings, build up your emergency fund, you know, all these other demands on your money. So term is really ideal. Just so you know, then there's the cash value. Life insurance, which, you know, an older generation, the whole life was the big cash value insurance policy, but there's universal life, there's variable life, there's variable universal life, and there's all kinds of twists and turns. And that always has a savings component to it, but it's more expensive. So term life insurance for most people is the best choice. And then save in your retirement savings and build up that emergency fund. I mean, that's, I think, very key.
Okay.
In terms of now, the in personal finance, when you have a child, if you have a child, you're going to want to have life insurance. You want to protect the child. But when you get married and there's no children involved, should you have life insurance at that point? And I think you should. Not much, but you could have a conversation with your fiance, spouse-to-be, about, okay, if one of us died, as you said, okay, let's just say you got hit by the bus. The proverbial bus does hit you. You know, how long would you like your spouse to grieve, be able to grieve without worrying about the bills? 6 months? A year? Or maybe she, you know, a lot of people actually go back to work because it keeps them sane, but maybe she might want to grieve and do something very different for the next 6 months. So you're not coming up with a big sum of money, but you're sort of having a conversation about, if something happened to you, I do want you to have this period of time, this period of grieving where you don't have to worry about money.
Okay. That makes sense to me. Here's one other aspect of this, and that is that with my job, I do know that we have just included as some of our benefits, we have life insurance worth a year of salary.
Okay, and that probably is just plenty. That's plenty.
Okay.
For most people, that's going to cover it. And does she have that?
I don't know if she has that.
Okay, because if she doesn't, then you'll want to think about getting, you know, some sort of small-term life insurance policy so if she walks in front of the bus, you know, you get your period.
Okay.
But what you have at work is probably perfectly adequate. It's just part of your employee benefits, and it's at a sum of money that would deal with the kind of situation I'm talking about.
Okay.
Have you guys, Ryan, talked about retirement and those kinds of things anyway? I mean, have you guys sat down and had a financial planning conversation together?
Not quite that far. We're looking at some big ticket items potentially soon, potentially not. Potentially buying a house in May. Our wedding's in March, and, you know, my sister's getting married. Actually, our wedding would be in October. My sister's is going to be in March. So there's lots of things on the horizon, and retirement's not really one of them.
Right. But I would, you know, I think where, Lizzie, you might be going, and in terms of thinking about this life insurance and buying a home and retirement savings, you know, I think what's really important is having a conversation and sort of setting up some kind of regular conversation so that both of you are on the same page, you're making the decisions are thought out. You know, and I've known people who, you know, for 3 months turned the finances over to one partner and then the next 3 months over to another partner, sometimes just doing it together. But this, it is absolutely critical that everybody is engaged in this conversation and this decision. And one of the things that always drives me crazy is when someone says, you know, well, I'm more responsible for the money. It has to be a joint venture. This is your little small business. This is your household firm. And so even on this life insurance, which I think is a great question to have, I'd have that conversation.
Okay.
It's always worth a talk.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the advice.
Thank you so much for calling us, Ryan.
Thanks again.
And Chris, thank you, as always.
It was fun.
Chris Farrell is Marketplace's economics correspondent. Chris, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Lizzie.
And be sure to send us your money experiences, questions, stories. You can post to our Facebook page or click on the contact link on marketplacemoney.org. Coming up, you and your work 401k. How to ask your employer about the confusing fine print.
What are all the fees I'm paying? What is the benchmark used for comparing performance of the funds in the plan to other funds? And here's another question, especially for larger employers. Are you getting anything out of it?
Plus, getting your retirement calculations right. What if conventional wisdom about stocks and bonds is wrong? All that and more is just ahead on Marketplace Money from APM. Let's face it, some of us are better with money than others. But even if saving and budgeting don't come naturally to you, you can learn good habits with discipline. A little military-style discipline. So we've got a drill sergeant of sorts for you, certified financial planner Jeff Rose. He's also a combat veteran and the author of the new book, Soldier of Finance. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You write this book from your personal standpoint, but also kind of as a series of lessons woven in with a military point of view. You went into the National Guard and then you were in Iraq. You kind of frame it. Each chapter's got dog tags and headings like destroying the enemy, paying off debt, with little worksheet lessons. And I want to ask you about one. You talk about a moment when you went into quite a bit of debt. Tell me about this military approach that you decided to prescribe to your readers.
I really do look at debt as the enemy. It ruined my father's life, and I saw what it did with him. There's different ways that you can attack debt. You know, for me, I think one of the ways that I'm most motivated by, you know, what's the debt that you and maybe your spouse or maybe just you just stress out about the most? And no matter the interest rate or no matter the size of the debt, you know, that's the one that we're attacking. And, you know, it's an all out blitz. You know, we're going to do everything that we can to get that debt paid off.
Give me another lesson that you learned either in the military or in your work as a financial planner that you think people should carry with them in their financial lives.
Don't become complacent to your financial surroundings. And, you know, when we were deployed, that was the lesson that we, you know, our leaders constantly put into us. Like, don't become complacent, because once you become complacent, you know, that's when the enemy can get you. And in this day and age, I just see it all the time. You know, people have no idea what their credit score is. They've never checked their credit report. They aren't saving nearly enough into retirement. You know, they might be putting money into their 401ks, but they have no idea, maybe one, how much they're saving, and maybe more importantly, where is the money being invested? You know, the 401k is probably going to be one of the largest assets that these people are going to have, you know, approaching retirement. And, you know, I want people to have more of a control and more control in their money and not be complacent. And it doesn't take a lot of hard work. That's the thing. I mean, in this day and age, there's a lot of information out there. There's professionals that can help you. You just got to choose to take the time and have somebody help.
Then we're going to let you help a couple of listeners. David, who wrote to us on Facebook, he and his wife are both in the Army Reserves, and he's got 9 years of service. And he wrote in saying, are there benefits to using the Army Thrift Savings Plan over a traditional Roth IRA? He's been using the TSP. You wrote about this in your book. What do you think between the two?
Yeah, you know, I never want to discourage somebody from saving. You know, so the fact that he and his wife are putting in money in their TSP, I mean, that's great. But I've actually never put a single dollar into the TSP. I was well-versed in the investment options. You know, I helped other soldiers put money into it. But the one thing that I liked about doing the Roth IRA for myself was control. You know, I had the ability to choose the investments I wanted. Obviously, I had a bit of an advantage because I was a financial advisor. So I, you know, had access to some of that information. As far as advantages, obviously, with the TSP, you can put a lot more into it. You know, I think up to $17,500 a year. And it does come out straight out of your paycheck, so it is easy. What I love about the Roth IRA is that it forces the individual to have to learn a little bit. You know, it takes a little extra work to open up a Roth IRA, you know, with a brokerage firm and maybe meet with a financial advisor, you know, and then choose the investment options. So I like it in the sense that you have more skin in the game.
All right, we've got another question with another military background involved. This is Terry in Pocatello, Idaho. And this is a question about her mom. So her father was a World War II vet, and he died 17 years ago. Her mother got some advice at a financial seminar for vets and their surviving spouses, and the speaker told her to take her retirement savings, which are more than $400,000, so quite a bit, divide $300,000 among her kids, and then buy a $100,000 annuity. And this advice kind of threw up some red flags for Terry and her siblings.
You know, this it could be a sound strategy, but I definitely would seek a second opinion. I actually work with a local elder law attorney that actually focuses on veterans and veterans' benefits. I've seen the benefits of these, but I also know there's a lot of planning. There's a lot of items that need to be taken care of, a lot of items that need to be addressed. And so I hope that, you know, there is some type of an attorney that's involved that knows this stuff.
So it would be worth sitting down with a lawyer, you know, even if they're talking about billing for an hour of their time, just to talk it through.
There could be, you know, with the annuity, how liquid is the annuity? Are they going to be tied up for a certain surrender period? You know, what kind of income needs does the mom have? There's just a checklist of different things that exist out there, and there's no way that they got everything they needed out of a seminar to make a well-informed move with that money, especially with that size.
Jeff, thank you so much for answering those questions. Jeff Rose is a certified financial planner and the author of the new book, Soldier of Finance. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
As Jeff Rose mentioned, if you've got a 401k from work, make sure you know what's in it and what you're paying for it. More than 70 million workers and retirees have money in 401ks, and recently, International Paper Company settled a lawsuit for $30 million over the company's 401k plans. International Paper denied any wrongdoing. Jerry Schlichter is a lawyer in St. Louis, and he brought the lawsuit against International Paper on behalf of a group of workers and retirees. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
This settlement with International Paper just took place. Why did you bring this lawsuit?
Well, Lizzie, I and my office only represent workers and individuals. We don't represent companies. And over the years, more and more people have expressed concerns about their retirement and having enough to retire on. There's risk that the employee or retiree undertakes. And people are concerned about understanding things like fees or what's going on in their 401k plan. I'll give you an example. My father was a civil servant. He worked for the federal government. And when he died, my mother inherited his pension. She no more would have been able to choose stocks than fly to the moon. And I'm not saying that disparagingly. I love my mother, who's now deceased. But she didn't have to worry about that. This new world we're in for the retirement system in America, covering 73 million people, the 401k model doesn't do that. It puts the employee or retiree in the risk position. and with little information or ability to appreciate what the information means. So we saw more and more, we were getting more and more questions about that and began looking into the practices of some of the companies that have 401k plans. We spent over a year, almost 2 years, investigating plans and industry practices. And frankly, I came away convinced that there were some serious abuses going on by some companies. Now, certainly not all companies, but by some.
You've brought lawsuits against some of the biggest companies in the country, Boeing, Kraft, Cigna. Do you think they are mismanaging employees' retirement plans in good faith, or are they not doing the due diligence because they just want to funnel the management toward one specific company? Why is this going wrong, in your opinion?
There are two categories of problems that we've seen. One is what I'll call asleep at the switch, where because it's not the employer's money, maybe whoever runs the 401k plan for the employer meets every quarter on Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock and goes through the motions of looking at what the fees are, looking at what the investments are, but doesn't really have a stake in it because the employer doesn't benefit or get harmed by it. It doesn't have to make up the amount if there's a shortfall. And the other category is frank self-dealing, where some, and again, I'm not saying all, some employers have used their own employees' 401k plan assets to benefit themselves.
So if you have a 401k plan from your employer, what should you watch out for?
Well, it starts with looking at the statements you get either online or in the mail. Try to look at the expenses if you can determine that. Also, look at the comparison that most statements have to whatever the benchmark, whatever the measure is that's comparing investment performance. Look at that to see whether it's exceeded it or not, because if it hasn't, you're paying fees for people to research stocks, and if you're not beating the market because you're paying a lot more for that than if you had an index fund, then there's a problem if that's a repeated underperformance. And if you have questions, you've got a right to go to your employer, whoever the 401k representative is, and ask those questions of your employer. What are all the fees I'm paying? What is the benchmark used for comparing performance of the funds in the plan to other funds? And here's another question, especially for larger employers. Are you getting anything out of it? Are you using the same managers for your own corporate plans or the same banks as are running parts of the 401k plan? Because we've seen, for example, using a bank in the 401k plan to keep track of the records of the balances and so on, with the employees paying for that, and every 401k plan has to have record keeping, but then the company using the same bank for loans.
Do you think this settlement will change the game a bit? Do you think we'll see more class action lawsuits against 401k plans?
The game is changing, Lizzie, already. Fees have come down substantially as a result of greater attention by employers to what their obligations are to their employees and as a result of this litigation. Going forward, I think that trend will continue. That's a good thing. That saved consumers actually hundreds of billions of dollars because there are over $5 trillion in 401k plans. And I believe that trend will continue as more and more companies become aware of the fact that this duty under the law to their employees is the highest duty under the law, and they've got to pay attention.
Attorney Jerry Schlichter is based in St. Louis. Jerry, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Lizzie. Thank you.
We also reached out to International Paper. The company said, quote, "The case in question was filed 7 years ago, and we are pleased to be able to put this behind us. This settlement agreement is not an admission of liability on behalf of the company." Like a lot of things in life, personal finance has some unwritten rules. Start saving early, don't get spooked by the markets. Try to keep half of your portfolio in stocks as a retiree. But that last one, well, it might not hold up. Tara Siegel-Bernard writes about personal finance for the New York Times, and she's busting a retirement myth of sorts. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you wrote a very interesting column that turns some advice about how you allocate a portfolio for retirement on its head. Lay it out for me.
Two really well-regarded researchers in the financial world, Michael Kitzes of Pinnacle Advisory and Wade Fow, a professor at the American College of Financial Services, came out with this new report. And basically, they found that holding as little as 20% of your money, your retirement money, in stocks upon retirement is actually less risky, and you're less likely to run out of money than holding, you know, 50 or 60% of your retirement money in stocks. And that's been the conventional wisdom thus far.
Right, because people are often told, you know, go into retirement with maybe half your money in stocks, and then you want to get more conservative over time. But these guys are saying buy stocks when you retire?
Exactly. There is a catch. They did find that, you know, holding as little as 20% in stocks upon retirement with the rest in bonds would result in less volatility. You'd get a smoother ride in your portfolio, and your money would last a few years longer. But there is a small catch. There always is one. And in this case, retirees would need to continue to buy stocks over the course of their retirement, probably about 1 percentage point more a year. So you'd buy 1 percentage point more of stocks each year as you get older.
I can't help but think about someone who retired in, say, 2005, right? And you're looking at your portfolio, and then along comes 2008, and boom, you watch it just get decimated. Does this advice hold for someone like that? Does this advice hold for everybody?
This sort of approach makes logical sense because the sequence of your returns in retirement matter. So retirees are most vulnerable when they retire at the beginning of their retirement. Because if you retire in a year like 2008, 2009, and the market crashes, you have to begin pulling money out just when your portfolio has, you know, been quartered or halved or whatever the case may be. So you're basically locking in your losses. That's why you're most vulnerable early on. If a crash came much later, your portfolio had a chance to kind of build up or remain steady. So if the market crashes earlier in your retirement, with this approach, you have less exposure to stocks at that time. So it protects you.
It all makes logical sense. And when you think about it on paper, when I read your column, I thought, oh, okay, that makes sense. And yet there's this tremendously emotional component to retirement and saving for retirement that runs totally counter to how we think about numbers. What kind of advice is there for people who are trying to stomach this approach? I mean, how do you sit there and say, I know I've just got to ride it out?
The idea is if you're buying stocks when the market's down, you're buying them when they're cheaper. By the time the market recovers, perhaps later in your retirement, your portfolio will be recovering just when you own a bigger slice of stocks again. And, you know, nobody's saying to run into this approach. You know, a lot of the financial planners that I spoke with said this is really thought-provoking and this is something that we should really be thinking about, but it's still a matter of kind of crafting approach that works best for you. The biggest reason why people bail out is because they didn't come up with a plan to begin with. So, you know, if the market crashes and you have come up with a plan, you have a diversified collection of low-cost index funds, and you put a lot of thought and analysis either by yourself with a financial planner, potentially, then you're probably better off just riding it out and sticking with your plan. If you didn't have a plan to begin with, that's probably the time to kind of check in with an expert, perhaps one that charges by the hour. If you don't want to pay a percentage of your assets, a lot of fee-only financial planners charge that way, but you don't have to create a lifelong relationship and have them manage your money. You can just pay somebody by the hour and have them do a little checkup on your portfolio.
Tara Siegel-Bernard covers personal finance for the New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for Marketplace Money this week. Let us know what you think of the show. Write us at marketplacemoney.org and follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, can a financial incentive change the way you eat? Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Lindsay Foster Thomas and Daryl Perinata, with help this week from Raghu Manavalan. Bill Lance is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the program. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening, everyone.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.